Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us. Coming up in just a bit, how solar arrays are growing food and opportunity, plus prairie wisdom, the life and folklore of Brother Placid Gross. And we begin Main Street today, approaching National Rural Health Day, which is on Thursday, November 20th. We're taking a closer look at how health systems are rethinking care in America's heartland. Traditional fee-for-service models are giving way to value-based care, a shift that rewards prevention, wellness, and long-term outcomes rather than volume alone. It's a model that's especially vital in our rural regions where access and innovation can mean the difference between early detection and crisis. Joining us from Essentia Health is Dr. Kathy Cantor. She's the Chief Population Health Officer for Essentia Health. We're going to talk about how her team is transforming care delivery from mobile mammography and home health visits to community paramedics and digital outreach, all designed to meet patients where they are and keep communities healthier longer. Dr. Cantor, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. It's great to be here and great to celebrate National Rural Health Day. For us, it's about really celebrating that strength and innovation and sense of community that really defines rural America and the patients that we serve.
We certainly are in rural America. And I want to start by discussing what value-based care is. I think for some it's, now what do I not get to do? What do I not get to access? How are they trying to shave dollars? But what's the core idea behind the shift in healthcare delivery?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, value-based care is really, it's a model, it's a care delivery system that rewards for patient outcomes and quality of care, of managing not just a patient, but a population, a community, rather than that volume transactional care. So the old fee-for-service volume world versus, you know, quality and outcome world.
What's a reward?
A reward would be, you know, dollars back. So, you know, There's risk in these models in the sense that, you know, if you do a great job taking care of patients with contracts of value-based care with health plans, then you share in some of those dollars that you save the health plan. Now, if you didn't do a great job and you spend a lot of money taking care of patients, then you lose money to that health plan. So there is some risk in this as well. But the bottom line is what's best for the patient and the community, and that's better outcomes and less time in the hospital.
One of the, I guess, ideas that's going to become very interesting for those of us who are older, for older Americans, is this idea of moving 100% of Medicare beneficiaries into value-based arrangements by 2030. Mm-hmm. That worries me. It's like, oh no, now we're going to have pre-approval for things. And now they're going to tell me no, and this wasn't even my doctor. But what does this all signal about where U.S. healthcare, I guess, is heading?
For me, that signals the traditional care models is really literally not sustainable. You know, the old days of being able to make up lost revenue out of volume and overcome inflation, we can't do that anymore because inflation is increasing at a higher rate than we can increase our volume.
And obviously, you're talking about the business side of operating a healthcare system.
Yes. I think the other piece is the workforce. So it used to be the many caring for the few. And now with the aging population, we have the few caring for the many. So there's a lot less folks in the healthcare workforce, and there's a lot more patients to be seen. So we've got to figure out a more effective and efficient way to do that.
Am I right to maybe be concerned, especially if I'm older, I'm going to weave my way back into pre-approvals and other things that necessarily haven't been part of the Medicare program in the past?
You know, I completely understand that concern. You know, we haven't seen that with our value-based care patients. 40% of our patients are in value-based care arrangements, and I'm not even sure they realize they are. So we haven't seen a lot of that prior auth and pre-approval need in our value-based care arrangements. So I think if it's ran right and everyone's on the same page, meaning the provider, the health system, the health plan, that patients should get the care they need at the time they need it and what's prescribed to the doctor.
So we're talking about this in a rural setting ahead of Rural Health Care Day, National Rural Health Day, which is Thursday, November 20th. Why is it so important in rural areas like where we live?
Great question. You know, 84% of our patient population lives in a rural area. So for us, this is extremely important and in what we do every day. So, you know, what we know is the lots of providers are leaving the rural areas. We're losing physicians and, PAs and nurse practitioners, these rural areas. So, you know, we've got to figure out a way to keep access there. And so it's about innovation and local connection together. How do we keep those two connected to stay, keep it local, and keep the trust within our communities?
What have been the barriers that rural folks have faced in accessing preventive care?
Great question. For me, there's two things. A, it's travel, and B, it's time off work. So if I've got to take, you know, half a day to go get my mammogram, that I'll probably get a point of work for missing. I'll miss wages, right? And again, it affects my bottom line as a worker, but I've got to take a half day to go do that. You're going to find that folks just can't do that these days. They need that half day's paycheck. So I think it's really distance and then the availability outside of normal work hours.
I want to rewind just a little bit, Dr. Cantor. You just told me, though, there are fewer service providers in rural areas. So how are you making those gains, so to speak, against those losses of what you've been able to provide in the past?
That's where a mobile mammogram comes into play. It's a great example of, you know, being able to take the care where it's needed, right? And moving around to communities and get really close to the local small communities for that, you know, diagnostic preventive mammogram. We had over 10,000 of our mammograms done last year were mobile mammogram. So that's huge for us.
Are you able to say that the quality of care might even be improved? That's probably the goal, but with this system, are you confident now in saying it's not less quality, it's greater quality?
I am. I think it's about connecting the patients with the right care at the right time. And, you know, this is highlighted in our congestive heart failure program. What we noted was that patients that were connected to the heart failure program, whether that was virtual or in person, had an all-cause readmission rate of 0.15%. If you were not connected to the heart failure program, you had an all-cause readmission rate of 21%.
That's a huge difference.
That's a huge difference. And so what that told me, it's about connection and it's about thoughtful connection, right? The right provider for the right patient and the right place.
We've talked about mobile mammographies, but I want to talk about other sectors of services that you provide across especially your rural service area and have you walk us through main initiatives that are demonstrating this shift to value-based care. Let's talk about home health services. Again, to me, on the face of it, well, that's going to get harder. They're not going to have the resources. But
if you can provide resources in a different fashion, such as community paramedics, so meeting those patients where they are, you know, in their homes, in their workplaces, what we found with over 700 patients at Essentia, a 65% decrease in emergency room use of those patients that we utilize community paramedics in.
Aren't you going to have trouble recruiting community health workers, though, to help?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because most places are having difficulty. We are not. We have, I want to say, 15 to 20 applications for every opening of community health worker that comes up. So it's thriving. That program is thriving here.
Tell me, please, about your resourceful platform. How does it, I guess, impact what it is that we're talking about today? How does it help patients address non-medical issues that impact health outcomes?
Yeah. So what we do know is 80% of many of our health reasons that we're seeing for healthcare, 80% of those are truly social determinants of health needs. And so what Resourceful is, it's a platform for us to be able to help folks that have these challenges with social drivers of health. So it's a platform that brings all the partnerships together, local communities in one, where it's a referral-based platform that's within Epic, our medical record system. And so we can pull that up as a referral for whatever our social driver need is and place it to the local community that can help that patient. And then they reach out to the patient and there's a closed loop cycle of that. I think so many times, you know, in the past, you know, I might print off some material for the patient, like, oh, maybe try to call these couple food pantries, you know, but now this is a direct connection. And then someone on the other end reaches out to the patient. And so there's a direct loop there where the patient gets included, and then there's a closed loop to make sure they get what they need.
Technology, I think you're saying, is going to allow that to happen more effectively.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it helps the patients find their resources and the provider quicker and sooner, and again, get them to their need quick, right away.
One thing I've wondered about, are we going to see, not just in the census system, but in healthcare across the country, fewer brick and mortar buildings with your name or names of other healthcare providers on them in rural communities as we go to this kind of more tech-based connection?
I think there may be that effect, but I still think we will need those facilities because there are still places that don't have broadband connection. So we'll still need facilities for patients to come to perhaps to connect to providers. So, it may not be seeing a provider in that building, but that might be their connection to the broadband piece.
I'm enjoying my conversation with Dr. Kathy Cantor. She's the Chief Population Health Officer for Essentia Health. We're talking about how her team is transforming care delivery in front of National Rural Health Day, which is Thursday, November 20th. Not only, Dr. Cantor, are we a rural state, we're also getting older. Is it a concern that those of us who are older are going to find it difficult to connect using the new technologies, et cetera, that we've talked about, and really just want that person-to-person connection, and we don't mind driving 45 minutes or an hour and 10 minutes to find it?
I think it's both. So, my parents are, around 80 years old, and they live in a very rural area, and they're very similar. So my mom still wants to drive 90 minutes to hear her echo report from the cardiologist. She doesn't want it done over the telephone. She doesn't want it done virtually, and I think that's okay. So, for them, that's her preference, and she's able to do that. So I think for those patients, that needs to still be available and that option. But we need to have that and both, right? Where if, gosh, I don't have my daughter to drive me 90 minutes today, can we do this virtually? Absolutely. But if you want to be in person, that local connection is extremely important for trust. And trust is really the bare bone of healthcare.
So you made the case that this is a must for sustainability. So what are your biggest challenges? And I want to talk about three areas. Operationally, culturally, you're going to be asking some of your employees, I think, to work differently, and then financially to the institution. Operationally first.
Operationally, it's about getting your platform set up on a strong foundation. So if the strong foundation isn't there, any virtual platform will collapse. So I think operationally, you better make sure you have a strong foundation, and we do. So as we set those platforms up, again, we want to make sure that the communities do have broadband access. If you're setting up something virtual and they don't have access, what's the point? So making sure that access is there, but again, making sure that if needed to be in person, we still have that availability as well.
Culturally.
Culturally, it's about teaching people to do work differently, and understanding still the heart of why they do the work is still there, but teaching them to do it differently and getting them to trust in the process and the outcome.
Financially for Essentia and for others who are in your shoes.
Financially, it's really about long-term sustainability. It's about being more efficient with the resources we have and being more thoughtful with patients to get things upstream so we're not chasing disease processes, we're preventing it.
Dr. Cantor, we've all seen in the news that subsidies, number one, for Obamacare might be at risk, that healthcare insurance premiums, either with or without subsidies, is rising. And especially that is important, I think, to those of us who live in rural areas. What do you want us to think about relative to the decisions that we're going to have to make about, gosh, can I even afford insurance like I've always had?
I think that's the question that's on everyone's mind, right? And so with those subsidies increase, that's going to hit the very folks that live in rural America the most. And we know that it's going to be hit them at a much higher percentage than many others. And so I think it's important to make sure those voices are heard at the state level, at the federal level, and that we understand that impact. And at Essentia, we're certainly concerned about that as well. And what we don't want to do is have folks forgo their health care or their insurance because of concern of cost. But we do have many people spread throughout Essentia that can help. So if they are concerned, they can reach out to the local provider because we have community health workers that can help them with resources with that and see what they qualify for at a state and federal level. But certainly what I would encourage those folks to do is reach out to the local provider, ask to talk with the community health worker because we can help them.
I mentioned that the year 2030 relative to Medicare a little while ago, and we talked about that. What's Essentia look like in 2030 if this transition goes as envisioned?
We have a big strategic plan of changing our model of care as we go through the next 5 years to prepare for that. It's really redesigning those care channels to be more efficient, more effective, and again, be able to have that local touch in an innovation fashion at the same time. So, but between the two, you still have to have trust. So for us, as we go through this journey, really with our patients and our communities, we still have to have that trust at the very core of all that we do. And hopefully patients can come along with us.
And as patients play now a more active role in value-based care, whether through screenings or digital tools or conversations with their providers, how should they approach this? What do you want them to think about as we end our discussion today?
You know, I want them to be engaged. What we do know is that engaged patients have much better outcomes and longer, happier lives. And that, you know, many times there's patients that say, I just don't want to bother the doctor. But, you know, I'm going to ask them to bother the doctor. Call. Make sure you're engaged. If there's something you have a question on, call us. Because what we don't want to do is have you wait, and then we're, you know, in a different position than we could have been. So make sure you reach out to us. We're here, and your physicians are really wanting you to engage with them and be proactive about your care.
Thank you, Dr. Cantor. My guest has been Dr. Kathy Cantor, Chief Population Health Officer at Essentia Health. She reminds us that value-based care isn't just about reducing cost. It's about a new way of saving lives, extending years, and maybe strengthening the health of rural communities like ours across the region. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for having us.
Fargo-Moorhead Opera presents Amal and the Night Visitors, the story of a boy, his mother, and three kings. Performances are November 21st and 22nd at 6:30 p.m. and November 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Yumcom Center. Details at fmopera.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, glad that you are with us. And on today's Plains Folk, historian Dr. Tom Easern shares the delightful prairie wisdom of Brother Placid Gross, a monk from Richardton Abbey whose life spans from the hard-working farm days of a German-Russian childhood to a later passion for preserving wit, customs, and folk sayings of his people. Now 90 and still going strong, Brother Placid's written a new book, Prairie Wisdom.
I cannot recall a conversation with Brother Placid Gross that was not a delight. He is foremost a man of faith who made his final profession under the rules of St. Benedict in 1967. Ever since, as a monk in Richardton Abbey, he has been known as Brother Placid. He was born and baptized, however, in 1935 as Aloysius Gross, one of 16 children of John and Magdalena Gross of Emmons County. Like most all Germans from Russia, when recalling his youth, Brother Placid adheres to a certain party line. Oh, we worked all the time, never had time for fun, they all say. He recently told a magazine author, all I did was work. In the morning, we did the chores and came in for breakfast and right after walked to school 1 mile. Which I don't entirely believe, because Brother Placid is a fun-loving, even puckish man full of humor. He made the New York Times in 2011 when the abbot liquidated the monastery's cow herd, of which Brother Placid had been the cowboy, actually in charge of all agricultural operations. Many were sorrowful on his behalf, and I'm sure there were unspoken regrets on his part, but not sorrow. Retirement as a farmer gave him more time for his other love, history, and, more particularly, the folklore of the German Russians. A product of that transition, Brother Placid's book, published in 2024, Prairie Wisdom, Folklore of the Germans from Russia. I'm not sure but what the title, Prairie Wisdom, is a bit of an inside joke. I think the ever-self-effacing author on another day might call it prairie foolishness, but if he did, that would be in the spirit of 1 Corinthians. There is a reason why, over the years, Brother Placid has jotted down and eventually published 277 pages of the observations, aphorisms, proverbs, and witticisms of his people. The author advises we can read his book from beginning to the end, but more likely we'll sample from topical sections of interest. Now, three of his siblings died in infancy, but inasmuch as most of the rest of them have lived to be 90 or more, and Brother Placid is out promoting his book at that age, perhaps we should start with the section on health, wherein we read, "One way to get rid of a wart on your fingers. Promise yourself not to look at it for a full year. After 1 year, when you want to look at it, the wart will be gone. If you go outside with a wet head, you will get pneumonia and die. If you eat snow, you will get polio. Oh, and the ultimate cure-all, chamomile tea, was prescribed no matter what the ailment. Chamomile has a soothing and relaxing effect, so it calms the nerves and eases the pain." Now, I'm going to skip the section of tongue twisters because, well, I'm on the radio, and go to Proverbs, the Sprichworten, for advice for our times. "Sauf dich voll und fresh dich dick, aber halt dich weg von der Politik." Drink yourself full, eat yourself fat, but keep yourself away from politics. You can order Prairie Wisdom, $25 and $5 handling, by sending your check directly to Brother Placid Gross at Assumption Abbey, Post Office Box A, Richardton, 58652. He dedicates the book to his mother, Magdalena.
That's Plains Folk, featuring the enduring insight and occasional mischief of Brother Placid Gross. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Still to come on Main Street, how solar arrays are growing food and opportunity. That's after this news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation in partnership with Strengthen ND, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees, TNT Kids Fitness, and Hip Hop and Hope. More at strengthenND.com.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Amy Bowers Cordalis is a Yurok attorney who has fought to protect her people's land, water, and way of life. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Cordalis about her new book, The Water Remembers.
You spent much of your life advocating for the health of the Klamath River and Yurok homelands. Can you share your personal connection to the water, the land, and the fish, and how those relationships have shaped who you are and the work that you do?
Well, Ayakwe, thank you for having me. My relationship to the Klamath River, my home waters, to our home fish, to my culture, to our place, our high country, it has made me. You know, I exist as I am because of those relationships. I'm from the village of Rekwoy, right at the mouth of the river, and we've been there since the beginning of time, and we have always had a fishing-based way of life. And one thing my dad says is we have fished the same salmon runs in the same exact places for so long that we and the fish now share the same DNA. So I like to think I'm part Chinook salmon too.
Yeah. And the Yurok tribe has faced layers of challenges over the time, from climate change and industrial impacts to colonial systems that disrupted, you know, traditional ways of life. How do these intersecting factors continue to affect your community and your tribe today?
In the book, I talk about how in 2002, there was an active ecocide against my people and really all indigenous peoples along the Klamath River, where water was diverted away from the river. And as a result, water levels on the bottom part of the river were the lowest in history at the exact same time that a massive salmon run came home, and it caused the largest fish kill in American history. About 70,000 adult salmon died. You know, that moment of ecocide, that tragedy that we all experienced, it really launched us into the Undam the Klamath River movement, which has now led to the largest river restoration project in history. The river is cleaner, the water is colder. The river is just coming alive again. And, you know, I tried in my book, The Water Remembers, to really outline and tell the story there so that others could learn, right? And that maybe they could use the tools and technique that we have used on the Klamath to preserve their own cultures, their own lands, their own waters. I titled the book, The Water Remembers, because it does. It remembers what it was like to be healthy and to support all this wonderful life and abundance. And I think it's working to get to that. And in many ways, so is humanity. So are we as humans. We have ancestral knowledge in our blood about what it was like to live in balance with nature, what it was like to be on a healthy planet.
You've done so much work across different areas, from law to advocacy to restoration. What inspired you to write The Water Remembers, and what do you hope readers take away from it?
My family inspired that, writing it. I was very lucky to be raised, you know, fishing in the Klamath at the family's traditional fishing holes. And so I just heard all these amazing stories. And then when I went through law school, I realized that none of these stories were in the law books or in any of the books that I had read going through, you know, my whole education. And the stories, the struggle of Indigenous peoples, you know, the fight, the resilience is so important. And it's such a critical part of the country's history that is untold. So it really is just a privilege to have the opportunity to write that story in the way that I wanted to write it.
Now here's Amy reading from her book.
I thought about my great-grandmother Geneva, who had lived through some of the most challenging times. She passed away in 1986, but I knew her. And I remembered her sweet smile and outstretched hand asking me to give her a hug when I was a young girl. My mind grew still, and I faded away from the water, the boat, and the dead fish. And then it hit me. I felt a wave of electricity move through me like it was her. She traveled on the wind and whispered, "It's your turn. Go."
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Planes could soon run on garbage. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
At last week's COP30 climate summit in Belém, Brazil, there were thousands of protesters, including indigenous peoples, wearing traditional garb, calling for a stop to the destruction of their lands and rivers to develop agribusiness.
The conference is being held on the edge of the Amazon rainforest, where deforestation and climate change have increased air temperatures and reduced precipitation.
There were discussions for the first time ever about the social justice costs of transitioning to a sustainable economy, which requires the extraction of minerals like cobalt and lithium to make solar panels, wind turbines, and electric vehicles.
Increased mining activity has driven deforestation and environmental destruction, not to mention human exploitation.
No representatives were sent to COP30 by the U.S. government. Nevertheless, many American governors and mayors are there. While the Trump administration dismantles climate efforts, China is rapidly reshaping the global approach to energy.
The Economist reports that the extent of the renewable energy revolution in China is nearly too much for the mind to grasp. By the end of 2024, the country had installed almost twice the solar capacity of the U.S. and Europe combined, and it produces as much renewable energy as more than 300 large nuclear plants.
Additionally, China is exporting its green technology, making more money from that than the U.S. does from exporting fossil fuels. However, China remains the world's largest producer of CO2 emissions.
Despite years of negotiations, the seven states that rely on the Colorado River have not reached an agreement on how to divide up the river in times of shortages caused by severe drought and climate change.
The federal government had imposed a November 11th deadline. It manages the reservoirs on the river, including Lake Powell and Lake Mead, and the current framework will expire next year.
Because the lower basin states of Arizona, California, and Nevada, and the upper basin states of Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Colorado can't agree, it's likely that the feds, through the Bureau of Reclamation, will impose a plan that could mandate water cuts.
30 tribal governments are entitled to about one quarter of the river's water and must be involved in coming to an agreement.
As the deadline passed, Becky Mitchell, representing Colorado in the Upper Basin, said at a conference that they would resist any cutback in their water allocation, while Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs said in a letter to the Interior Department that it must impose cuts on the Upper Basin states.
Mitchell said she is still optimistic that the seven states could reach a consensus.
There's some new buzz about beavers. Past research has shown that their dams can help create habitat for fish and store groundwater, but a new study says the critters can help boost pollinators.
A team from the University of Stirling in Scotland studied wetlands made by beavers and found they had a higher number of hoverflies and butterflies when compared to human-built ponds.
Pollinator populations are plummeting worldwide from habitat loss, climate change, and pesticides. So the finding that beavers can help support environments for insects is welcome news.
The increase in hoverflies is particularly important because they are unsung heroes of many ecosystems as the second most significant pollinator after bees. Hoverflies also protect plants from aphids, are food for birds, and even help break down organic matter in gardens.
Beavers create habitat for hoverflies and other insects by randomly felling trees and grazing on vegetation. Eager beavers boost biodiversity by continuously modifying both aquatic and terrestrial environments to keep soils moist, which provides ideal breeding conditions for insects. And finally, the shutdown has ended and airline schedules are slowly returning to normal, but there's a vexing problem that won't go away, the amount of greenhouse gases that planes emit.
Aviation contributes nearly 3% of total global carbon emissions, and air travel is expected to double by 2040.
A solution may soon take off. Researchers at Harvard University and Tsinghua University in China say planes can now run on garbage.
They found that our trash, from food and plastics to paper and metals, can be converted into a sustainable aviation fuel that emits less carbon.
Sustainable aviation fuels, which are currently derived from cooking oils or crops, have been slow to get off the ground because of high production costs and low supply.
The team studied converting solid waste into jet fuel through gasification and say the potential is sky high. They found in a life cycle analysis that it could reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80 to 90% compared with conventional jet fuel.
This waste-based fuel would help reduce methane emissions and decrease water and air pollution by sending less garbage to landfills.
The main headwind could be scaling up gasification systems worldwide. However, the low-carbon fuel can work in today's engines, so cutting emissions can start immediately for an on-time departure.
That's it for this week in water. H2O Radio's newscast is powered by you, our listeners. Donate at h2oradio.org by December 31st and have your gift doubled.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
Main Street continues on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we look now at an innovative farming method taking hold in the Midwest. It's called agrivoltaics, growing food beneath solar panels. In Missouri, farmer Linda Hetzel harvests crops in the shade of her solar array. And in Minnesota, emerging farmers are gaining land access inside solar fields. As heat intensifies and farmlands become harder to secure, this dual-use approach could offer a sustainable path forward for agriculture and clean energy.
Shortly after 8 a.m. on an August morning, Linda Hetzel is clipping herbs, vegetables, and produce from the vines on her farm north of Kansas City.
Italian parsley, cutting celery, peppers. I'm trying peppers, which you normally think would be only in full sun.
Hetzel's peppers are growing in raised beds and are shaded by 18 solar panels hoisted more than 8 feet off the ground.
There's no blossom on it yet, but the plants look healthy.
This is Hetzel's first growing season experimenting with agrivoltaics. The solar array that powers her home also provides shade as she harvests produce in the Missouri heat.
In this heat, it's really bad. I have to get up at first light because by 10 o'clock, stuff wilts.
The potential for solar energy infrastructure to offer a respite from heat for farmers and the food they harvest has been studied over the last few years. While the jury is still out on whether solar energy can be married to the most typical types of farming in the Midwest, such as large-scale row crop production or raising cattle, small-scale produce farmers like Hetzel are finding success. Other farmers across the Midwest are asking whether agrivoltaics can solve another problem, access to land. Increasingly, small-scale farmers have trouble finding land near their metropolitan customers. It's something Kashua Berry thinks about a lot.
Every time I see land space, I'm like, food.
Berry is the farm director at Minnesota-based nonprofit The Food Group. The organization offers a variety of training programs for people who want to learn to grow organic food sustainably and sell them locally. Over the years, Berry has seen farmers ready to start their businesses only to be stymied by the same challenge, securing a stable place to grow food. Undeveloped land around the Twin Cities can be prohibitively expensive for beginning farmers, and renting leaves them susceptible to changing prices and lease terms. So Berry has taken to brainstorming creative ways to find land for emerging farmers.
My kids make fun of me because they're like, Mommy's probably just thinking about how many tomatoes or how many watermelons can we grow? I'm like, yes, you know me so well.
Berry and the Food Group have partnered with a solar developer to pilot long-term farming leases for the land within a solar array. The project's farmers get to use the space for free, and the solar company gets the land maintained, something Stacy Peterson says sheep are also especially good at.
These solar companies have created hundreds of thousands of acres that need to be managed across the country. And they need land management and vegetation management, and solar grazers are perfect for that.
Peterson is executive director of the American Solar Grazing Association, an organization working to connect solar developers with shepherds. Over the past few years, sheep grazing amid solar arrays have become an agrivoltaic success story. Whether agrivoltaics can suit other types of agriculture without decreasing productivity of the farm or the power plant is still being studied. But small-scale food farmers in Missouri and Minnesota hope the future is made in the shade. For KBIA News, I'm Jana Rose Schleiss.
This story is part of Harvest Public Media's coverage of food systems, agriculture, and rural issues produced by KBIA. As farmers work to adapt to a changing climate, agrivoltaics could help grow not just crops, but the next generation of farmers. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Nature versus nurture. That's a decades, maybe centuries old question when it comes to things like predicting who is more likely to turn to a life of crime. But for brain coach Lyle Wilds, who recounted his compelling story at the October The Tell Show in Fargo, a terrible collusion took him off the straight and narrow path he'd been following up to that point. Here's Lyle's story told in front of a live audience at the 4 and 4. And a little warning, the story contains references to drug use and manufacturing and may not be suitable for all listeners.
Hi, my name is Lyle Wilds, and I spent 20 years of my life growing up, 20 years of my life messed up, 20 years of my life locked up, and now I'm spending 20 years of my life speaking up. So I just want to start by saying the first 20 years of my life, I lived on a farm in Lime Ridge, Wisconsin. I was a farm boy. I was kind of an anomaly in wrestling, and I got to the state. And when I was at the state, my coach told me that this guy is from Coleman, Wisconsin. He's pretty tough, he said, but they're both undefeated. You go out there and do the best you can do. He never said that to me before. He always said, bring me back a victory. So I lost that match, and I'm still blaming him yet today. So I am a brain coach. I'm an external brain coach. And the reason I say external is because you are an internal brain coach. You talk to yourself all day long, and you tell yourself what to do. So when I graduated from high school, I got a job in a bank. I got bored with the routine of success and left. I went to college at the University of Wisconsin in Platteville. I got a degree in philosophy and one in sociology. I was supposed to be a sociology professor in Sauk City, Wisconsin, but I had an automobile accident. I split my forehead, broke both eye sockets, both cheekbones, this jawbone, and shifted my skull an eighth of an inch. And so as a result of that, they pronounced me dead on arrival, but I heard a doctor say that, so I thought something was messed up. And so so I passed out. My wife was screaming. I'd only been married 4 months. My wife was screaming. They took me to the hospital in Dubuque, Iowa, and there saved my life. I got out of the hospital, and I was a different man. I was married 5 months. I got out. My wife came to pick me up. Everything worked. My skull was damaged. And so when she picked me up, I didn't even know who she was. I told her I didn't like her. I wanted a divorce. My life went into chaos. I got my degree. I graduated. I went to Berkeley, California, to the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley. I got bored of the school there, and I left. And so I went back to Wisconsin. I was a professor at the University of Wisconsin in Richland Center, Wisconsin. So now I'm starting to realize that I'm messed up because of my accident. So the kids wouldn't study very well in school, so I kicked them all out of my class. I threw chalk at them. I took a yardstick, chased them down the hallway. They obviously canceled my rest of my education as a teacher. And then I decided that when I had my accident, the doctor froze my face, completely froze my face with cocaine or Novocaine or whatever. And I had such a wonderful feeling after that moment. I'd never done drugs, never smoked, never drank. And I always remembered the doctor telling me, you're talking too much, we may have to tape your mouth shut because I see what this agent does to you. And I asked him, I said, you mean I could feel like this anytime I want to? And he said, don't say that. I didn't say that. So I leave. I go out. I get a job with my brother. We're the first trucking company in Wisconsin to transport mobile homes and set them up in one day. And then I decide I'm going to manufacture cocaine because I want that same feeling again. So I manufacture the cocaine, synthetic cocaine. Nobody knew how to do it, but Bill Stoddard did it in 1905 in Germany for his doctor's degree. And I said, if he can do it in 1905, I can do it in 1985. And so I did. I gave it to my dog first to see if he'd live. And he did. And he was pretty ambitious. And so I got in a conflict with my partner, and the cops were called, and I was arrested. And she told them that I had a laboratory to manufacture synthetic cocaine, which I did. And so they took me in. I was in Mauston, Wisconsin. While I was there, they didn't know who they had or they didn't know what I had. And so they gave me 3 years. I did 3 years in maximum security prison because I wouldn't tell them anything about my program. And then I got out, the feds picked me up and gave me $585,792,410 in federal prison, which is 22 years. And when I went into the prison system, now this is my incarceration, I went into the federal prison system, they knew my past. I didn't have any visits for 20 years because I was too hot. Everybody wanted to know what I was doing. And so they asked me to create a class that would repel the negativism of incarceration. And I said, why don't you just change the culture? That'll never happen in your lifetime. So I said, okay. So I made the class. I made it. I taught it for 18 years. I get out of prison. And the federal judge that sentenced me, his office, asked me to come back and talk to them. He said, we spent $500,000 housing you. Now we're going to spend $10,000 to hear you talk to us. He said, I don't know if that's right. But I wrote a book about it. That book is now in 4 federal prisons. I am now working with Michael Mrzenich, who is the guy who created the cochlear ear implant. We're doing a research project in Wisconsin or in Minnesota, and we're going to be proving that crime is a neurological issue. It has nothing to do with willpower. Thank you very much.
What a powerful story from brain coach Lyle Wilds from the TELS October show. You can Google Lyle Wilds, W-I-L-D-E-S, studying the neuroscience of incarcerated individuals, as well as his fascinating story. The TELL is a live storytelling event at the 4&4 in downtown Fargo, above the Side Street Grill and Pub, and the next show is Thursday, December 11th at 7 o'clock.
This is Dakota Daybook for November 18th. On this date in 1932, a 2-day demonstration of Boy Scout activities was held at the Wahpeton Indian School for troops from Richland and Wilkin counties. Physician and author Charles Alexander Eastman, a Sisseton Wahpeton, Dakota, served as an advisor in developing the National Boy Scout movement and its Native American lore component. In 1931, Boy Scout and Girl Scout troops were organized at the school, and 2 log cabins were built for their activities. The Boy Scout cabin soon became a favorite gathering place for regional scout events and local groups, including a square dance club. Its chimney was built with stones donated by scout troops across the country and around the world. In 1933, the public was invited to an open house at the school where shop and home economics work were displayed. Featured was an 18-foot totem pole constructed by scouts in shop class. Motorists often toured the school and stopped to pose for photos beside it. In 1955, Native artist Woody Crumbo created his most famous painting, Spotted Wolf's Last Request. Later, the Wahpeton Indian School Boy Scouts received a gift from the Cochere, California Boy Scout Troop known as the White Boy Indian Dancers. The gift was a signed print of Crumbo's painting, accompanied by the story of Private First Class Clarence Spotted Wolf of the Fort Berthold Reservation. Many of his relatives were students or staff at the school. Spotted Wolf was killed in World War II on December 21, 1944. Before his death, he wrote home describing his funeral wishes. If there was a parade, he wanted a soldier carrying the American flag to lead, followed by a cowboy leading his saddled horse to carry his spirit. Crumbo's painting captured that vision. Mourners surround a traditional funeral scaffold draped in an American flag. Overhead, Clarence and his horse rise into a sky of intricate designs. He looks back over his shoulder, raising the flag high above a dome of clouds. On the ground lie pottery, blankets, beadwork, drums, and childhood toys. The signed print and its story hung for years in a school hallway after the scout cabin was repurposed. Later rescued from a trash bin, they were reframed and installed in the administration building, where they continue to greet visitors with a powerful visual story. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lee Sir Drake. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Coming up tomorrow on Main Street, the Barnes County Museum is inviting the community to a special Thursday open house to preview interpretive panels that will soon be installed across Valley City as part of its World War II Heritage City designation. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you can join us again.